Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Means, The Guardian's weekly dive into the murky waters of Brexit. This week marks exactly a year to the date that Britain is due to leave the European Union. And we thought we'd return to a subject that we last visited about a year ago, back in the early days of Brexit Means. A subject that brings the reality of Brexit home like no other, really, because it's about individual people and their lives. Citizens' rights. It's also a subject on which, on the face of it, and if you believe the politicians, which is perhaps never an infallibly good idea, a great deal of progress has been made in the Brexit talks so far. The President of the European Council, Donald Tusk, for example, wrote to EU27 leaders ahead of their Brussels summit last week to say that EU citizens would be fully protected from the consequences of Brexit. Theresa May has written personally to EU nationals in the UK to say that Britain is honouring its pledge to preserve their rights, while the Brexit Secretary David Davis has said the draft Article 50 divorce agreement and the deal reached last week on a transition period go a long way to giving the greatest possible legal certainty about their future to EU citizens in Britain and British nationals on the continent. Now, I may be wrong, but I suspect that our two guests this episode, Nicola Hatton of the 3 Million, which represents EU citizens in the UK, and Jane Golding, who's chair of the campaign group British in Europe, which pretty much does what it says on the tin, will have something to say about that. Together, they speak for around 4.6 million people in the UK and on the continent, all of whom risk being more or less directly affected by aspects of Brexit. They are both on the line, and here in the studio with me is Lisa O'Carroll, The Guardian's Brexit correspondent, who's done such a lot to cover the concerns of EU citizens in Britain and UK nationals abroad. Welcome to all of you. But before we come to you, let's just hear first from one anxious Briton abroad. Now, Chris Williams is a freelance software engineer. It's a job he's been doing for nearly 20 years, and it takes him all over the EU, Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, for short and medium term contracts. Chris, hello. Can you tell me first, where are you in Europe at the moment?
We're registered as being resident in The Hague. And have been for the last year. But my work for the last 2.5 years has been based in numerous locations, but working for the same organization, which was NATO. So started off in Maastricht, then moved to Belgium, and then moved down here to The Hague in the Netherlands again.
Freedom of movement, EU freedom of movement is very, very important for your work.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely critical. Because the market I'm looking at for work are all of the EU countries, because I'm currently eligible to apply for work and to reside in any EU country. As a freelancer, you tend to follow the money. So you look at the scope and complexity of projects and also the daily rates. Mm-hmm. And skills shortages play a big part in this as well. So it could be that in one particular year, Germany has a shortage in my skill set, and I can move into quite a long project and at a good daily rate and live in Germany for a year and a half, 2 years.
Right.
And until the contract completes.
We've reached an agreement on the transition deal. We've seen, the draft withdrawal agreement. What is there in there, or I suppose I should say, what is there not in there that concerns you?
My understanding is that we would be limited to continue residing in the EU country that we are currently in. Mm-hmm. So in my case, that would be Holland, mm-hmm. The Hague.
The other thing that might complicate it, I suppose, is the idea that after Brexit, British nationals would effectively be sort of third country nationals. But companies in EU member states are often obliged to apply a kind of EU citizens first policy, which would further reduce your opportunities, wouldn't it?
Mm, absolutely. And it's already started, even though the negotiations are still pretty fresh. When I searched for work, for example, today, I looked at some sites with large providers. I mean, these are all UK-based companies, mm-hmm. providing work in the EU. Mm-hmm. I noticed that there are stronger statements of eligibility against each of the roles now. So it quite clearly states you must be eligible to apply for this role in this country. And after Brexit, I won't be eligible. So I couldn't even put my CV in.
That was Chris Williams in The Hague. Thanks. Jane, it's fair to say your organisation, your members still have many concerns, don't you? Is it true that continued freedom of movement, so the issue that particularly concerned Chris there, the right to move and live and work freely across the whole of the EU, is the biggest single concern? Because, I mean, I think a lot of people in Britain kind of assume that most Brits on the continent are pensioners, are retired, but that's really not the case, is it? Could you tell us a little bit about the profile of British citizens living in the EU first?
Yes, thank you, John. Of course I can. Yes, there does seem to be a misconception that in the UK that most Brits on the continent are retired. And in actual fact, the figures show that nearly 80% of us are working age or younger. Which, in fact, around a third are between the ages of 30 and 49.
Wow. So that's a huge proportion of people who are working. And, I mean, how important is that the ability to change countries, and not to be landlocked?
Well, I think it's not exactly the question of being landlocked. I mean, will happen under the agreement is it's clear that our rights will only be confirmed in one country. But it's certainly true to say that continuing free movement is absolutely vital to many of our members because many people work cross-border. Mm. And it's also all the linked rights to free movement. So right of establishment, that means the ability to set up businesses across the EU. Professional qualifications, the right to have your professional qualifications recognised beyond the country we live and work in, mm-hmm. and also the issue of providing cross-border services.
Right. Could you give us just maybe a couple of examples of members who, you know, might be particularly hard hit by what we think at least is going to transpire?
Well, if you take in the example of somebody like Chris, who does a series of short-term and medium-term contracts in different countries, I mean, his livelihood is very dependent on the possibility to move freely across the EU and to move where his contracts take him on a regular basis. I mean, that's one example. Mm-hmm. Then we have small caterers who move across the EU to provide catering services in different countries, maybe three or four countries per year. Again, for them, free movement and the ability to move easily across the EU is vital for their livelihood.
Okay, so Nicola, turning to you, is it possible to pull out one particular concern of your members, of EU nationals living in the UK? We've heard a lot about the new settled status that the British government's proposing. It kind of sounds quite straightforward on the face of things. It's supposedly going to be quite easy to obtain, at least compared to the incredible performance of getting sort of permanent residency. Does that give EU citizens in the UK broadly what they want? And I suppose equally importantly, can you trust the Home Office to administer it?
A single issue, or the most important issue that really resonates with EU citizens, is the application procedure. Because settled status is not automatically conferred. Mm-hmm. So all 3.6 million EU citizens will have to apply, and if they don't, they won't be documented. Also, they could fail the application procedure, and people are worried that if they don't qualify as a lawful resident, which is defined by European legislation, they might not be getting settled status, even if they reside here for a long time. So there's a real worry that the Home Office might select, whether it's because of errors. Mm-hmm. And we know that the current error rate is about 10% on the permanent residence applications. Mm. Or they might want to select because some citizens are not contributing as much as others.
Hmm.
So there's a real worry that not everyone will go will get documented through the process.
Okay, and is there any kind of transparency about what those criteria will be, do you think?
We are preparing a series of questions to the Home Office ahead of a meeting with the Immigration Minister, Caroline Oakes.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment, we got 129 questions.
Wow.
And that's the problem, is that on one hand, we see EU leaders and the Prime Minister congratulating themselves on securing a deal on citizens' rights.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the other hand, we're not getting answers from the Home Office. And it's a difficult place to be because we want certainty. We've been asking for certainty for 640 days as of today.
Hmm.
And we can't get certainty if we don't get answers to our questions.
Absolutely. Lisa, that's 120-odd questions. That's an awful lot, isn't it? I mean, you've been covering this area for over a year now. I mean, would you say, as the politicians appear to be saying, and as Nicola just mentioned there, that citizens' rights have been protected and preserved and won't be affected by Brexit? Is that the impression that you have?
No, I think talking, you know, over the past year, 18 months, both to Jane and to Nicola and others involved in this campaign and just individuals, if you took a graph and you drew something like, a cloche, you would be able to chart the impact that people like Nicola and Jane have had on politics. So very early on, December 2016, we had that case of Monique Hawkins, the Dutch woman who was threatened with, a prepare to leave letter, even though she was perfectly entitled to be here.
Mm.
And that shot the issue of EU citizens right up to the top of the agenda. The European Parliament stood up straight, launched an investigation, the Commission, Barnier got involved, and so it went. And now I think that that curve is on the way down. And I think that is the real fear, that the issue that politicians like Barnier, Tusk, as we know, told European leaders last week, much to the annoyance of the 3 million, the British in Europe, that a deal was done to guarantee the continuation of the rights, and that was not the case. And that would be my fear, is that EU citizens, neither groups, they have done fantastically well, punched way above their weight, but they don't have political clout in a way that a political party has. They don't have a direct seat at negotiations. And as we know, the more powerful the lobby is, the greater the voice. So money talks, so the banks have a voice. I think EU citizens are in danger of being let down, and particularly Brits in Europe. I think, you touched on the freedom of movement there. EU citizens in the UK, although some rights do flow from residency as opposed to their passport, but you still Nicolas, you will still have the right to go back to France at any point and to go to any Europe. And your children, if they've got passports of your nationality, will also have that right. Like I will retain a right as an Irish citizen in the UK, but British citizens won't have that. And that is a really serious diminution of rights.
Yeah.
And I think when it comes to employment, you've touched on an issue in relation to freedom of movement again through the Chris Williams story. And, you know, people in Chris's position will point you to recruitment agencies who deal with the IT profession, and they require that third country nationals have access to the Schengen area. So a Briton in Europe won't, you know, will have less rights, as I understand it, than a third country national who, say, comes in from Australia or India or Japan and gets permission to work in say, Germany.
I mean, this is clearly the big issue. I mean, this clearly sounds like a really significant diminution of rights, Jane. Where has that come from? Why has this what appears to be a really critical aspect of, you know, of British citizens' rights on the continent of Europe in the EU, why is it has it not been included in the withdrawal agreement and the transition deal? What's gone wrong there?
I think what's gone wrong or why it's not been included is because those rights are seen as particularly attaching to the fundamental status of EU citizenship. The view of the EU has been they can only confirm the rights that we're actually using, our existing rights. I mean, they've talked about existing life choices, but not able to confirm or safeguard future life choices.
But when we started in this, Jane, I can remember down at the House of Lords in the summer, straight after the referendum, and the House of Lords EU committee had got stuck into this straight away. And there was a professor there from a university here in London, and she was talking about acquired rights and how international law did not protect EU citizens. But nobody knew what acquired rights meant. You know, even she found it very difficult to define that. So we've gone through all that process. And one of the defined rights was surely your freedom to move around. That is a legacy of you exercising your freedom of movement rights. So that by right, you should be able to have that post-Brexit. You should have special status to differentiate you from that Australian, that Indian or American who comes into Germany to work as an IT director or whatever. And that's the void.
That's the question I'm trying to get at, Jane. Is it? I mean, has there somewhere been a political decision here? We know very clearly that one of the main drivers of the Brexit vote and of the whole Brexit sort of the push for Brexit here in the UK was, you know, the desire of the British government to restrict the rights of EU citizens in the UK. Somewhere along the line, are you feeling the backlash from that? Is that what's actually been happening here?
Well, I think it is partly that, because I think that obviously at the beginning, back in May last year, the EU made a proposal, and the proposal looked as if it was going to safeguard all of our existing rights. Then, of course, the UK came back with a counter-proposal, which effectively was all about a new, lesser status for EU citizens in the UK. And then we got the negotiations, and inevitably, once negotiations start, there are compromises. And I think that has a lot to do with this. I think it's also a particularly legalistic approach to defining what our acquired rights are, or if we have any as EU citizens, that they can only be confirmed in the country where we're actually exercising them. Whereas, of course, our argument from the beginning was we have a primary right under the treaty. It's a right of free movement, and that extends across the whole territory of the EU member states. So that's been our argument from the beginning, and we're still pushing that argument. So I think that has been where the problem has come. Instead of having our rights confirmed, it's life choices that have been confirmed here. And as we've said from the beginning, life choices are based on rights and not vice versa. We have rights and we've exercised those rights. And based on those rights, we've made life choices. It's not our life choices that are to be protected. It's our rights.
Exactly. Nicola, there's an issue as well for you and your members, EU nationals in the UK, also with several rights that you're concerned about. One, for example, the right to continued access to the sort of the European Court of Justice, should there be any dispute about what your rights are in the UK. Where are we on that? That has been obviously one of Theresa May's most strident red lines, that there should be no involvement at all of the European Court of Justice. She said that, you know, the relevant parts of the withdrawal agreement affecting citizens will be written into UK law. Is that enough for you? Where does that whole process stand?
It's still not quite clear. So we know that the ECJ will still be valid for 8 years after the transition period. But it won't be for the rest of my own life or the life of the majority of EU citizens here. But the ECJ is not necessarily the complete solution. So if I've applied for their status and an error is made, I want to be able to appeal and make the appeal in the country, mm-hmm. and possibly to an administrative body that would be above the Home Office. Mm. And at the moment, there's a lot of uncertainty about this. Firstly, the government is pushing for an exemption on the immigration data through the data protection deal. Mm-hmm. So if that goes through and we're campaigning against that, it means that I will not have access to my data, or my solicitor will not have access to my data. Mm-hmm. So how can I form an appeal if I don't know what the Home Office got on the record? The second thing is that the appeal right I will get is not necessarily in-country. So I could make an appeal, but I could be deported first, because the lack of the status makes me deportable straight away. And what we're starting to do now is say to people, make sure you keep record of all the documents that could be useful in case this application process is not as straightforward as promised.
Yeah.
We've been told that it will be an app, that they will check the data with governmental database, but if they can't find you, you will need to provide evidence.
Mm.
And it is a real worry.
Lisa, I mean, that's certainly true, isn't it? There are an awful lot of holes in these agreements as they stand, aren't there? How much scope, realistically, do you think is there for those holes to be filled in? I mean, how much is citizens' rights any kind of priority?
The issue now is that it's wrapped up in the a wider negotiation about the future relationship between the EU and the UK, because the withdrawal agreement has been agreed. And as Jane and Nicola know, that Article 32 relating to freedom of movement was taken out completely from the withdrawal agreement. And you've got to question what is the political channel that needs to be used to crowbar these issues back onto the agenda. And you can see how freedom of movement is part of, and indeed the ECJ and future arbitration is part of the wider conversation. But what you would fear is that the real life implications and consequences for EU citizens won't be at issue. It will be the wider political top-line stuff.
Yeah. And that citizens' rights will just become a pawn of pawns in the overall process.
I do think that I just wanted to come back to what Nicola mentioned about the Commonwealth citizens. He was referring to a 55-year-old man who'd been a Jamaican chap, I believe, who'd been here for decades, came here as a teenager, I think, has children and grandchildren, has prostate cancer, but because he hasn't got paperwork, the Cancer Hospital produced a bill of 54,000 and refused to treat him, and Theresa May has refused to back his cause.
Mm.
And I think that is really, really scary for EU citizens, because as Steve Pearce, a professor of EU law in Essex University, said to me this week, the whole CSI issue is still there and not resolved, while the UK government has promised the comprehensive sickness insurance, which... / private insurance for those people. So it was a requirement for people who are self-sufficient. So that would be students and self-sufficient people. Largely, you might be stay-at-home mothers or spouses who are being supported by their partners. And the government promised, it never implemented the mm-hmm. requirement, which is Europe-wide requirement. And the feeling here was that because NHS was socially universally available health service, that wasn't actually CSI. So the government, after a few run-ins on EU citizens applications for permanent residence, agreed to drop that, but it's not legally binding. Mm. And it's not written into the withdrawal agreement. Mm. And as Steve Pearce points out, is that there is a risk that that could be litigated. Mm. And you cannot rely on a government promise.
Exactly. I just want to touch briefly on a couple of the other very specific rights that people are concerned about. Jane, you mentioned them briefly, but recognition of professional qualifications and how concerns about how individual EU member states might treat third country citizens, because which is, of course, is what British nationals will be, because, you know, in individual member states can, there's quite a lot of leeway in how they can, deal with and register or otherwise third party nationals. Could you just say a word or two about those?
Yeah, I'll perhaps talk about the second question first of all, how EU member states will treat third country citizens, and go back to what Lisa was saying, and we were discussing before about all the gaps in the agreement. Mm. And at the moment, you know, the question is exactly how those gaps might be filled. First of all, by EU rules on third country nationals. Then there's the national rules, and then in each member state. And then there are the provisions of any future EU-UK relationship. So basically, there's going to be three layers for the people who are covered by the withdrawal agreement. The withdrawal agreement, any legislation at EU level, because there is some common immigration policy for third country nationals at EU level. Mm-hmm. How that will apply to us, and how the future relationship will apply to us. And of course, we know the future relationship will depend very much on the UK negotiating position. It could take years. And as far as the third country national legislation is concerned at EU level, at the moment there's no clarity about if and how it would apply to people who are covered by the withdrawal agreement. So it's all very uncertain. Mm. And then you add on the layer of national legislation applies in each EU 27 country. Mm-hmm. So it is very complex and very uncertain at the moment.
Right.
So that's one side, on one point. On the professional qualifications, I'll just say very quickly, during transition, I think things will remain as they are now, because all single market legislation, if there is a transition period, will continue to apply. But after transition, a lot of qualifications will be covered by the withdrawal agreement. So for those people who fall within the scope of it.
Right.
But the qualifications will only continue to be recognised in the country where you live, right, in the country of residence.
Yeah. Okay, so that's back to this whole question of effectively being locked into, or at least find it'll be much, much harder for people to move afterwards.
Much harder, and then there are, in fact, also some qualifications that simply won't be covered.
Hmm. Okay, Nicola, one of the EU citizens in the UK's concerns as well, I understand it, is this whole issue of family rights. Is that an important thing for you? What can you say about that?
The deal basically restricts the family reunification rights that we currently have by preventing EU citizens to bring future partners. So on paper, some people say, well, we're getting more than what we thought we would get, because actually more than what the British citizen can do right now, because their rights were downgraded
right
in 2015, I think. Mm-hmm. And ours were not, because we were protected by the EU. Mm. Another benefit. But so my daughter, for example, she's 13. Mm-hmm. As a French citizen in Britain, she obviously doesn't know what her future partner will be. So she will remain European, she will travel in Europe, she might even study in Europe, mm-hmm. but if she finds love over the tunnel, that person she will want to bring back will basically, we have to go through the hoofs of the Home Office like any third country national.
Yeah.
And there's this like age issue here. There's a discrimination against the young in that agreement, because it doesn't protect them in terms of their rights.
Mm-hmm.
And then they won't be able to have the life that we've had because of the limit on family reunification. There's also a limit of the number of years you can be abroad. So if you're a young European, young EU citizen living in the UK, you'd be able to go and travel in Europe with your sales status and come back, as long as you don't do that for more than 5 years.
It's a kind of a diminution of rights all round. Yes. Jane, just very briefly, is that an issue for British citizens on the continent if they wanted to? I mean, for example, you know, if someone wanted to retire back to the UK eventually with an EU spouse, is that something that might cause problems?
Yes, absolutely, because we would be in the same situation. In fact, in some ways worse, because this would even apply to existing family members. So if I wanted to move back to the UK with my German husband in future, if he is viewed as a third country national in the UK, then I will only be able to return to the UK with him if I can fulfil the conditions under the quite stringent UK immigration rules on income or assets. So, I mean, this will be a barrier to British citizens who live outside the UK at the moment returning to the UK.
Yeah. I mean, Lisa, one thing we haven't mentioned here, or you mentioned it right at the very beginning, is the role of the European Parliament in the overall package. Is it fair to say that they've got European citizens' backs a little bit more than the other institutions?
I think it is, and I think that is the main worry when your leading politicians in the European Commission and in Europe, in Britain, are saying the deal is done, and everybody knows the deal isn't done. Mm. How do you bridge that gap in terms of public perception? And Guy Verhofstadt has been very vocal and tweeted last week after the withdrawal agreement was signed that he would block the deal if it didn't include all the rights that EU citizens deserve. However, I think speaking to one of the MEPs this week who said it's unlikely that the European Parliament, when it comes to it,
when push will comes actually, to shove,
will actually block it at all. But that's the European Parliament seems to be where a voice can be heard.
Yes, where the fight back at least might. Yes. Kind of wrapping up now, Nicola and Jane, just briefly, you're going to carry on, presumably, making yourselves heard. Are you optimistic that you will be? I mean, is there scope for the holes in these agreements that we've been talking about to be filled in a way that's sort of satisfactory to you? Jane, start with you.
What I would say is we will keep fighting and we will keep pushing through the political routes. And obviously we have got strong support in the European Parliament and pressure. They can continue to put pressure over the next months. They put out a very strong resolution on the 14th of March. And one of the red lines was free movement for UK citizens in the EU, as well as lifelong right of return for EU citizens in the UK. So we will continue to push through those political routes and then also think of other ways of getting our voices heard, even though most of us don't have a vote in the UK.
And Nicola?
Well, Lisa talked about counterpower earlier at the beginning, and she's right that we haven't got the strength of political parties, but we have a voice. And I think The Guardian is actually one of the best newspaper to relay that voice when there's something that's obviously not quite right. We're turning our organization into a membership organization, really, to increase that voice and make sure that we actually really represent people. So I would really encourage people to join and add their voice to the campaign, because there's a lot to play for. The agreement that was agreed is a framework agreement. And actually, there's a lot of room for manoeuvre for the British government. So we're not going to stop. We're going to actually intensify the campaign because we want the Home Office to do the right thing. And I believe there's a lot of good people in the Home Office that I've met that they really want to document EU citizens. And if we manage to convince them that, you know, what they're planning to do might not have the effect they intend, but we can really help them. doing that.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, good luck is all I can say.
Thank you.
And keep up the good fight. Thank you very much indeed. That's it for this week. My thanks to Lisa, to Jane and to Nicola for joining me once more. If you have any questions, comments or suggestions, do please email us at brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. Please subscribe, review on all your favourite podcatchers. Join the discussion on Twitter. You just need to search for Guardian Podcasts. Till next week then, I'm John Henley. The producer was Rowan Slaney. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.